When it comes to compact construction equipment, Takuchi is a globally trusted brand. The famous red and grey machines you see everywhere are built to perform on any site, delivering power, precision, comfort and reliability from 1 to 15 tons. Now offering a lineup of proven compact track loaders, versatile tool carriers for construction and highways. Choose machines that work as hard as you do. Visit Takuchi-mfg.co.uk to find out more.
It's Wednesday, the 15th of October, 2025, and this is Reconstruction, with David Taylor and Phil Bishop reviewing some of the construction industry news from the past couple of weeks. How are you doing there, Phil?
I'm okay. I could do with the sun come back out again, but it is, you know, middle of October, so I can't really complain.
Dry, though. It's dry down here, which is unusual in the West Country.
Oh, not here. Not here.
Oh, dear. Okay.
I've got loads of garden clearing to do, and I want to be dry, so I can get out and do that. Anyway, enough about us. What's happening in the industry? What do I want to talk about this morning, David?
Well, I think we should talk about tool hirers, because I think there's been a very interesting development in that sector with two of the biggest players, in fact, HSS and Speedy. I think you posted this story, was it Monday? I mean, HSS has been in the news recently because it warned that it wasn't going to submit its latest results with Companies House by the given deadline. And a warning went out that if it missed the deadline, then its shares were going to be suspended. And sure enough, it did. So we were all wondering what was going on here, if the company was about to fold or whatever it was. Yeah, they attributed the delay to the delay in filing their accounts to business development initiatives, which is a rather broad phrase. It said the board is actively advancing a range of promising commercial and strategic initiatives focused on long-term value creation, which all sounds very positive. But I think what actually happened certainly wasn't what I was expecting. Did it come as a surprise to you, Phil?
It did come as a surprise to me, but it was the blockbuster announcement that they had hinted that it was going to be. In terms of, you know, hold the front page, it didn't disappoint.
Mm.
That should explain for anyone who's not been following what's been going on here exactly what happened. It was the 6th of October, they noticed this, so it was shortly after the last time we met. What they've done is that there are two bits to HSS Hire Group. There is the Hire Network, HSS Hire, which is the shops, and there's HSS Pro Service, which is an online service, sort of a big call centre.
I knew nothing about that, I have to say.
Well, this is the interesting thing. We'll come on to what it is in a minute, because they've been talking up. I mean, the trouble is with companies who talk about, I mean, I can think of other companies that say, you know, we're not a whatever we think might think they are, you know. A baker's or a butcher's. We're a yeast and flour solutions company or something. And what H says, you know, we're a digitally enabled blah, blah, blah. And you think, yeah, they're just saying they've got a computer, but they're still a tool hire shop. Shop with a computer. But actually, this pro service business, which they've been building up and shifting towards. I mean, in 2020, they shut half their shops on the back of COVID.
Yeah,
I don't mean temporarily, I mean shut them down. They've been going through this shift for a number of years now and have been crowing about it without anyone, well, certainly without me, and I'm sure other people, really kind of understanding that this is the way, this is a very definite direction of travel. Instead of having shops where people walk in and dealing face-to-face with customers, it's all acting as an agency, a brokerage almost. Mm. And they have a depot of stuff, but it's all very far removed from the customer and all very sort of Uberish and whizzy. To the extent that we still haven't seen the 24 accounts, I don't think, but the latest accounts, 2023 accounts, of the £349 million turnover that the group made, 290, which is off the top of my head, two-thirds or something, or three-quarters, three-quarters probably, came from this pro-service business.
Yeah.
And what they've done, they've signed, what they announced last week, is that they signed a deal with Speedy, where HSS Pro Service is five-year deal. All the Speedy's taking on the inventory of HSS Pro Service, and HSS will do the back end stuff, you know, managing the hire side on that. I mean, I'm not entirely clear exactly what Speedy will stop doing, but it's a tie-up with HSS for the Pro Service bit. Pro Service will act as a fulfilment provider for Speedy customers, and they're selling off the what we think of as HSS, the stores, the hire network, is being sold to a private equity outfit called.
And what are they going to do with it? This, I mean, there are loads of question marks over this. So they're getting rid of the branches. I mean, obviously those are assets. 39 branches and 65 builders merchants. I'm not quite sure what they mean by that, because I don't think of HSS as being a builders merchant at all. They're selling it off to this outfit called Endless LLP, a London private equity investor. What are they going to do with it? Are they going to put it up for sale or sell it off piecemeal?
Well,
about the inventory?
There seems to be a split in inventory. I think some inventory goes with the hire shops and some inventory goes with what is now going to be called Post Service Building Services Marketplace PLC. There is equipment. I'm not sure how much. I don't know what the split of equipment is. I don't know if there's different types of equipment that goes with Post Service and stuff that goes with the shops. But what are they going to do with it? Well, they, I'm sure, will aspire to, you know, grow it, make money from it in 5 years' time, flip it, which is generally what private equity people do.
They'll run it as a tool hire operation.
Presumably.
As HSS.
Why else would they have taken it on?
I don't know.
But it surprised me to learn that this pro-service business, which, as far as I can see, I mean, yes, it's got inventory, but it's basically it sounds to me like an agency, a brokerage, a 10% outfit.
Well, but as you said, or just an app. I mean, you know, I think about tool hire. I think about electric drills, breakers, saws, all that kind of stuff, and a hire desk, and a depot, and, you know, a warehouse, and fitters who maintain all the equipment. That's what I think of tool hire. And then there's somebody, you've got a point of sale, got a computer at the point of sale, and a bloke behind the counter, or a woman behind the counter. But they seem to have got rid of all that and just kept the computer. And that's what I don't understand. It doesn't seem as if it's like sort of smoke and mirrors, that they've actually ceased to exist, but they are apparently continuing as some sort of intangible thing in the cloud or whatever it might be.
Yeah, I mean, it's clearly a big money-making operation. They recently did a deal with the facilities management company, ISS, where Pro Service will be its official hire supply chain partner.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a £6 million deal where HSS Pro Service will provide a managed service of all that tool hire and equipment hire supply chain that supports ISS activities. Now, whether HSS... I mean, if HSS is just supplying the tools and equipment, I understand that. But if it's... I think it's doing more than that. If it's actually saying, well, we don't have... You know, whatever. It does have powered access, so it can provide that from HSS. But if there's equipment that it doesn't have, it's acting as a broker, it's enabling, it's being a middleman, which I can understand if you're a big facilities management company. I mean, a lot of construction companies used to have plant managers and their own plant operations. Mm-hmm. And even though they still use just as much plant and machinery and tools, they've outsourced it all, both the actual inventory, the supply of it. But I think they still... A lot of them do the hiring in-house, or at least even if they outsource the management of the operations of the hiring, the hire desk, they still got to, you know, tell the middleman what they need. So
well,
it's still going to be
someone,
you know, at the ultimate client who says, we need 28 ladders or, you know, 52 buckets or whatever. But What worries me about the HSS Post Service, I mean, obviously they regard that as the high value bit and they're keeping it, but maybe to a lesser extent tool hire, but plant hire in general, I mean, the bigger the machine, the more it's true.
Hmm.
It's a relationship business. You know, and you actually, you know, you actually need to be able to know, or I think if you have the relationship with your customer and the customer, you know, can see you and it's got your number and he knows the face of the person who's, you know, oiled the machine and checked that it works and looks after it. And if something goes wrong, you've got comfort that and if the name of the owner of the company, their name is on the side of the machine, even better.
Yes.
Because it's that sort of real hard and fast accountability. Now, I say all that, but look at someone like Sunbelt, a plant is a huge, great, now American corporation, which is, you might think is very distant, but it still has that local presence. And I think a lot of, you know, small builders will go into their local Sunbelt, you know, shop, store, yard, and know the people there, and there are local relationships.
Yeah.
So it's not just necessarily about being a small family business providing, you know, that sort of tight customer service. You can be big and still provide a local service.
I guess you can, but I mean, I'm a big fan of those small local businesses. My favourite tool hire, I mean, I'm a DIYer, obviously. I'm not in the industry. So when I need to hire a tool, it's very rare and it's usually just a breaker or a drill or something like that. My favourite hire company was South Moulton Tool Hire, and I'll give them a shout out. They no longer exist, unfortunately. I went in there to get a breaker.
Obviously not often enough.
Well, I clearly didn't go in often enough, but I think a lot of local tradesmen did. But it was had a little yard in South Moulton. Lovely bloke there. Always, you know, that's the thing. You go in there, it's like going into your local shop. You know the bloke. I mean, that doesn't necessarily know you, but you deal with the same chap every time you go in and you get good service. And he did. He kept the equipment in good nick. Everything was ready for you when you went in to pick it up. He couldn't keep the business going, or I think he just wanted to retire. So now, yeah, if I want to hire a tool, I go to one of the big chains around the area, which is fine, but it's not quite the same.
I don't think HSS is interested in the DIYer, frankly. Though.
No, I'm sure they're not.
Or certainly what HSS Post Service isn't interested in the DIYer. HSS Hire, the stores, I'm sure is. We'll take business wherever you can get it.
Of course. No, I think those on something like Pro Service Building Services, I think, yeah, they'll want account holders, won't they? They'll want you know, big orders and regular ones.
Yeah, and big organisations that they can.
Yes, absolutely.
Take the strain, the bureaucracy, and the hassle of all the tool and plant hire side of things. And maybe if you're just dealing with national accounts, you don't need that local service. But I still think even with national accounts, you need to know, frankly, who you're going to take out for dinner, take to the races to say thank you. You know, there needs to be that sort of normal business relationship where you...
Yeah.
And by becoming physically removed and becoming a virtual business, it seems to me, is what ProService is. I don't know, given the competition, I wonder how long it can last without eventually saying, oh, maybe we do need to be a bit more, you know, boots on the ground.
Yeah.
In people's...
Well, I mean, HSS has got a fairly checkered recent history, hasn't it? Because, I mean, it up until, I think it was 2021, it finally got back into the black.
Well, let's start from 2015. I mean, it's already private equity owned before 2015. So it hasn't really had, you know, the care and love of an investor. Obviously, they're financially invested owners, but what I mean is, you know, the someone's name above the door for a long time. But in 2015, they floated on I don't know if it's alternative investment market, but on some
type of
on stock exchange. And yeah, it took them until 2021 to finally turn a profit. I mean, they were loss making for years and years and years. And it was really seemed a bit of a basket case. And what has turned them round is this whole shift towards being, you know, a digital-enabled tools and plant solutions provider, which, you know, we may scoff, but it got them finally into profit. And what's particularly interesting is in the year that they floated, of the IPO, there, that same year, there were rumours that they were planning to merge with Speedy.
I don't remember that.
Way back in 2015, 10 years before this deal has actually happened. So you could say this deal might have been 10 years in the making. almost 10 years to the day, a couple of months shy, there were big rumours that HSS and Speedy were in merger talks. Now, Speedy denied it. I mean, they were both loss-making companies at that stage. I mean, Speedy have had their ups and downs over the years as well. Yeah, so that was...
Interesting.
An interesting, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I wonder, when I first read this story, and I thought, well, we're getting rid of these 39 depots and all the rest of it, that must mean lots of job losses. There's not, as far as I can tell, much talk about job losses, but they do say approximately 100 employees will transfer from Speedy to ProService. Don't know what they'll be doing, but I mean, you know, obviously they'll be redeployed. And 300 will transfer from HSS Hire Service to Speedy. Now, does that mean that basically nobody loses their job? They're just redeployed?
Well, there shouldn't immediately be job loss. In fact, in the short term, if anything, there's going to be duplication because HSS Hire Group is splitting in two, and both bits of that need, you know, personnel department and you know, IT departments and other you know, backroom stuff.
Well, that back office stuff, yeah.
I suspect that the people moving from HSS, from ProService to Speedy are people who actually are, you know, looking after the equipment on the inventory side of things.
Yeah.
And people move from Speedy to ProService are probably backroom type people, I'm guessing. I mean, that's how... I don't know. But the what's being sold to Endless is an operating organism that will need the same sort of back operation that presumably was supplied by the group, which is staying, broadly speaking, with ProService. Yeah. Or maybe the two bits had their, you know, completely separate back offices as it was. I doubt it completely, but I don't know. But what I know is when private equity people come in, they aspire to grow the business and bring in jobs, but the first thing they'll look to do is cut cost.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. Well, it'd be interesting to see what Endless does with all those depots and all the people and the inventory and everything in there. I mean, if they continue trading as HSS, that would be very confusing for a lot of people. But I suppose maybe it won't because, I mean... HSS Pro Service is dropping the HSS bit, so you know there will be
HSS Hire will still see those, you know, the big billboards on the big sheds kind of thing. That will remain what we think of as HSS.
Yeah,
and the bit that was the bulk of the business and the money making bit of the business becomes
invisible, basically.
In fact, I think it will. I don't think we'll see it. And yeah, we haven't mentioned that it will. This new entity, ProService Building Services Marketplace, will be 10% or 9.9% owned by Speedy as part of this tie-up. I think that will grow. I wouldn't be surprised if it, you know, if things progress and work out for both sides within 5-10 years, it will just be part of Speedy.
Yeah, I think so.
Or maybe the other way around. Maybe ProService will take over Speedy. But I think if Fuller coming together,
I don't know how
the end game.
Speedy is the bigger player, surely.
No, you've got me. What's Speedy?
I don't know. I always assume Speedy is number one. Well, maybe, yeah, I don't know if Speedy isn't.
416 million revenue last year. So that's it's bigger, but not huge. But,
yeah, not massively bigger.
Not massively bigger.
Well, another one to watch anyway.
Yeah, all interesting stuff. Next topic. What do you want to talk about next, David?
Well, there's this external insulation debacle, which was all over the news this week. And I think a lot of us saw it coming, didn't we? That there was this, you remember the government and its various initiatives to encourage people to retrofit their homes and make them more energy efficient so that we could hit net zero by 2050, all the rest of it. And most of the initiatives, if not all of them, seem to have failed in one way or another. It's this news that apparently the National Audit Office has done a report on the government's energy company obligations scheme, ECO scheme, which was this
son of Green Deal.
Yeah, sort of green. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, son of Green Deal. That's more or less what it is. Energy companies were required to fund energy efficiency measures by their customers, basically. So all their customers says, right, well, you know, I'm in a cold, damp house. A cold house, anyway. And I'm going to.
Wasn't damp before.
No, it wasn't damp before, but I'm going to wrap it in external insulation so it's nice and cozy and I won't have to turn on the heating so often. And what that's done, in 90% of cases, apparently, which is astonishing, is that the external insulation has been badly applied and it's actually caused huge damp problems in a lot of homes.
You're underselling it. 98%.
What did I say?
90.
90? Oh, I meant 98. No, absolutely. Yeah, nearly all of them. Nearly all of them. I think that's they say it's between 9,000 and 13,000 homes. That's 29% of the total have major issues that need fixing.
Yeah, that's the internal insulation.
Oh, that's the internal one, is it? Okay, yeah.
Internal insulation is not so bad. Only 29% of the total had problems.
That's right, yeah. So, no, 22 to 23,000 homes with the external wall insulation have got these problems.
I mean, clearly there are problems with insulation, full stop, but it's the external wall insulation which is the real issue.
And it really is a tremendous mess. It's just, I mean, the three main causes are poor quality installations, weak government oversight, and inadequate audit and monitoring. And I think probably of those, probably the second one is the worst because it's allowed the other two. You know, weak government oversight. They had thought this is a good idea, and in their hurry to find some way of clawing their way towards net zero, they've said, right, let's do this. Let's subsidise or get the energy companies to subsidise these retrofits, and it just hasn't worked. And I think, go on, Phil, you're going to say something there?
What it comes back to is, with all the Green Deal initiatives that we're knocking around, they all seem like great ideas. It's the problem we've still got today is that there aren't enough competent companies around to do the work.
Yeah.
And they come along and say, well, you know, I've got a badge, I've got a certificate, I'm a member of this trade association, I'm legit. But, oh, you're obviously legit. And maybe someone in the company is legit, but at the end of the day, people doing the work don't really know what they're doing because they're not properly trained or they don't properly care. I mean, there are two issues. One is incompetence and one is crookedness is putting it too far, but I think, but just slapdash attitude.
Yes, yeah.
You might know what you're doing, but don't care enough, or you might actually just not know what you're doing.
Yeah, true.
Lack of pride. Let's say lack of pride rather than crookedness.
And I think, if you remember when the Green Deal came out, you know, there were these registered companies could register under the scheme. And I went online, I think we mentioned this on the podcast, actually, I went online and found out who would be available to, I don't know, insulate my loft or double glaze my windows in my area. And the nearest one I could find who was actually registered was in Leicester. I'm in North Devon. So
I remember this conversation. I remember this conversation. Yeah. Yeah,
but I also think, and I'm getting on one of my hobby horses here, is about people's lack of appreciation or understanding of traditional buildings, because I think putting external insulation on a house, a modern house, say something built in the 60s, 70s, with a cavity wall which hasn't been filled with insulation, might be fine. Actually, it might work, but if you wrap a building in an impermeable membrane, effectively, you're trapping moisture inside. And with old buildings, Victorian houses with single skin solid walls, and maybe just a slate damp proof course or something like that, you're going to wick that moisture up through the wall. It's not going to be able to escape. And I think that's what's happened in a lot of these cases. I think it's a lack of understanding of what's appropriate for the type of building. And yes, what they say here, which is a lack of understanding of what this these systems are supposed to do and how they're supposed to be applied. And inevitably, almost, you're going to have tradesmen all over the country saying, look, there's this huge opportunity. Let's become external wall insulation installers. All it needs is put a few battens up, nail the stuff on, render over it, and Bob's your uncle. You know, you can move on to the next one. It's all subsidised, so you know you get a guaranteed income for it. And I think probably nobody just saw that was going to be the obvious thing that would happen. You know, they were too focused on the good side of it, and they hadn't really scrutinised the possible downsides.
Well, for me, the biggest negative about this whole, I mean, obviously it's worse for the people who've been stitched up with, their homes being made grotty by what's something supposed to make them better. Mm. But this whole scandal, and it is a scandal, it's less devastating but far more widespread than the, the Grenfell-type cladding scandal.
Yeah.
And it has, just like the Grenfell scandal did, the cladding scandal did, it has really added fuel to the fire of those people calling for a builder's licensing scheme.
Absolutely, yeah.
And they're saying, they're now saying, well, let's start with retrofitting. You know, you're not going to be allowed into anyone's house to fix anything or put in a cat flap unless you've got a license from the government. Now, whether the people are saying they want the government to run this licensing scheme or they see a money-making opportunity for themselves and they want to, some trade association wants to run the licensing scheme to print money. But I said before why I think it's a licensing scheme is not only a dreadful idea, it won't work, it won't solve the problems, and it will just be inherently bureaucratic. It will be an obstruction to enterprise. It will slow down growth even further. And, I mean, certainly, I don't think the Labour government are going to even countenance it in the current state of the economy when they're trying to be builders, not blockers.
No, quite.
I mean, they'll simply be blocking every building, full stop, and say you can't do anything without a licence. And then the whole argument about, what are called grandfather rights. Well, I've been doing this job for ages and I've got all these certificates. Surely, I don't have to go through these hoops, do I? And just like with the old CPCS card things, it will just be a nightmare. But it's very, very easy for, a politician or the lobby group who want builders' licences to say, look what happens without proper regulation. 98% of insulation jobs leave houses worse off than they were before they started.
Yeah.
We clearly need regulation. Now, that is a very, very seductive cry. But you do have to think, will regulation sort out the problem? Is that the right way forward? And we need to think long and hard before going down that path, as I said before.
Yes, no, I agree. I mean, maybe if you had a system whereby you had to get a trained specialist or a surveyor in to sign off something like this, would that solve the problem? Maybe it would.
Solving the problem.
Maybe a third party.
If you just make the energy company liable, it's not only saying they've got to stump up the money, it's saying, right, this is effectively, if it's your subcontractor, it's effectively your employee, maybe not directly employee, who's doing the work. So if an insurance company or some bigger business that has the liability, they're going to make sure it's done properly. Some Jack and his dad and a ladder, they don't really care about liability or whatever. They're just going to do the work and move on.
Yeah.
But if you've got whether it's a legal and general or an EDF or whatever, who are bearing liability for the nation's housing stock, I think they're much more likely to take care and make sure that people who are doing the work know what they're doing.
Yes, absolutely. Should we move on to another topic, Phil? One of your favourites?
I don't want to spend long on this because we've spoken about the Lower Thames Crossing forever and a day. And we still haven't made it anywhere any nearer the starting gate. We've got planning permission. We still don't know when it's going to start. But I couldn't help but react in a slightly cynical way when the press release came through about a hydrogen. I think they called it a digger. It's actually a backhoe loader. A hydrogen-fueled backhoe loader was deployed from the Midlands to Kent with hydrogen written on it in big letters to be seen in a field digging a hole for some reason or other, putting up fences or something, to show how green the Lower Thames Crossing is. We've got a hydrogen digger on site, and this shows. And I mean, virtue signalling of the highest and most cynical order, I think. And they, look, we've got this hydrogen fuel.
Well, they promised it would be a hydrogen fueled project, didn't they? I mean,
yeah, but when they promised
diesel
that,
free, I can't remember. Says
it's going to be diesel free. We'll only be buying 140,000 litres of diesel a week or something. It won't be diesel free.
No, of course.
I mean, it's quite easy to promise it won't be diesel. It will be diesel free. Because the thing ain't going to start for about another 10 years and the landscape will have changed. So by 10 years' time, diesel might be quite hard to get. But there'll still be diesel on, you know, on certain machines building this tunnel and this road project. You can be sure of it. And a lot of the cars riding on these roads and going through this tunnel will still be powered by diesel and petrol in 10 years' time when they start, even 20 years' time when it finishes. But their claim is going to be the first major infrastructure program in Britain to be carbon neutral in construction, with an awful lot of offsetting. I wrote to them and said, how much offsetting are you doing to this? And said, basically said, we don't know yet, but it will be ISO 14068-1-2023 aligned offsetting plan. And we'll publish this once all opportunities for reduction are exhausted. In other words, we are going to have to offset to get to this, you know, carbon neutral thing, but we don't know how much, and we don't yet know how what we're going to do.
It's just window dressing, isn't it?
Yeah, it's just hot air and a promise. And I also asked, if you're powering all your machines by battery, hydrogen, and/or HVO instead of diesel, and you're using all these low carbon materials, low carbon cement, you know, all fantastic and state of the art. All of these things carry a price premium. Certainly at the moment they do. Maybe in 10 years' time when this project finally starts, it won't. But at the moment they carry a huge price premium. And so I said, what price premium is this carrying? Is this not gold plating the project on a scale that HS2 has been? All these reports in the past year or more into why is HS2 overrun so much? What HS2 did is that they started work too soon. You can't accuse LTC, the Lower Thames Crossing, of starting work
no,
too
that's
soon.
True.
They sorted that problem out. But they're still gold-plating it in a way that HS2 did. And no one seems to have twigged on this. So why are we gold-plating Lower Thames Crossing with all this sort of, you know, lovely but expensive green stuff? And I said, how much is this costing extra? So in response to my question, how much extra is it costing? They're saying, our commitment to carbon reduction is leading to a more resource-efficient design, driving innovation in our supply chain, reducing dependency on imported fossil fuels, and helping create the skills and jobs of the future.
Yeah, but that, everybody says that.
That's how much more it's costing.
Yes.
what they're saying is, we're on the side of the gods. We're doing good. We're, you know, on the right side of history. We're doing the right thing.
Yeah.
Very well possibly true. But if that's costing 28 hospitals, it's not, I'm exaggerating, but if it's costing 28 hospitals or 5,000 cancer cures, I think the public have a right to decide whether, you know, which way the money should be going.
Yeah, good point. It's not just the gold plating of the project. There was a report in The Guardian this week, which in fact I only just saw a couple of minutes before we recorded this podcast, that the government decided that it doesn't want national highways, and I can never remember what to call them. They're called national highways at the moment. They don't want national highways to be running this project anymore because they're worried that it might be delayed. So it's being taken in hand, isn't it, by the Department of Transport?
That's what The Guardian reported. I haven't followed that one up. I noticed that New Civil Engineer did, and they asked National Highways, is this true? And National Highways said, no, not true. They asked the Department for Transport. The Department for Transport said, no comment, which sounds to me
that's not no, is it?
It sounds to me like, it's true, but National Highways haven't been told yet.
Yeah, interesting.
But the thing is, whoever they're trying to work out a private financing deal for this.
Yes. And
maybe the Chancellor will say something about this in her budget statement, autumn statement next month. As I've said before, if someone's stumping up private money for it, they want a degree of control. They want
of course.
A degree of say over how it goes.
Yeah. So
and as I said,
see what happens with that.
I apologise. This is our 100-something-somethings podcast we've done, 188th podcast this is that we've done, David. And it's probably about the 92nd time I've banged on about the Lower Thames Crossing, and the 58th time I've banged on about the stupidity of a builder's licensing scheme.
Yeah.
So I need to find something new to talk about. One thing we haven't talked about, and I'll just do this briefly as an and finally perhaps, I think it's a topic that the construction press has not been very hot on. But as a reader of Private Eye, I am always interested to read the stuff that they've been running over the years on, I think it's called ACOBA, the something committee and appointment. Maybe it's not ACOBA. There's a committee which monitors jobs that senior public servants, any politicians, particularly cabinet ministers, take when they move from public sector to private sector or from government to the private sector. And the amount of scandals there have been of, you know, for example, the guy at the top person at the Ministry of Defence who's in charge of deciding, what guns and tanks we should be buying, going to a defence contractor
suddenly as soon as he retires.
Who does the buying and the selling of guns and tanks to the government, and the conflicts of interest. And I must admit, when I got this press release from Lange O'Rourke saying we've made some changes to our board and we've put this chap on our board, Mark Foy, who until very recently was the chief inspector and chief executive of the Office for Nuclear Regulation. He's going to join as a non-executive director next month. I thought, but he only left the Office for Nuclear Regulation in July. That seems a bit quick. Is this, has he got... And my initial antennae twitched, and I thought about it, and I thought, actually, do you know what? This has got nothing to do with that. This is not... There's nothing sinister about this. Unusually for me, because I hadn't normally been...
Yeah, I was going to say.
Cynically. But as soon as I gave it more than 2 minutes thought, as soon as I let my instinct subside, sniffing for the dirt, I thought, no, actually, Lange O'Rourke have already got... They're building Hinkley Point C. They've got the contract effectively for Sizewell C in Suffolk by law with Brigg. So they're already in there. This guy, Mark Foy, is not going to help them win any work. The Office for Nuclear Regulation doesn't award contracts anyway.
No.
It polices and stops, it makes sure that people are doing things the right way. Now, if some guy who's the absolute expert at making sure things are doing the right way is going to work for a contractor who's trying to do things the right way and wants to do them even better, that can only be a good thing. It may look like he's a gamekeeper turned poacher, which has slightly dodgy overtones whenever you talk about gamekeepers turning poacher, but it can only be good for A, Lange O'Rourke, and B, the construction industry, that someone of this guy's expertise is
on
in
the
their
board.
Boardroom. And not only that, he's chairing a newly formed board-level safety committee at Lange O'Rourke, which has got to be a good thing.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
So, sorry, folks, nothing to see here, move on.
No, exactly, yeah. I know what you mean. It does look like, it does look as if there's... some horse trading going on. But no, you're quite right. It can only be a good thing. Yeah. There have been some other appointments at Lang O'Rourke as well, haven't there?
He wants
to keep everything local, doesn't he? This is basically what it boils down to.
This is what... I don't know whether Ray O'Rourke lives in Jersey, but I know...
I believe he does.
Does it? Okay. I think there are elements of... in the past, bits of Lang O'Rourke or the ultimate holding company has been registered in all sorts of strange places. But he's got a company secretary coming on board who's a Jersey employment lawyer. And is there another person who's coming on?
There's
another woman existing, Heather McCullum, who's already on the board. She currently chairs the Audit and Risk Committee on the board. She's becoming the senior independent director. So you've already got, she's a Jersey resident already there, and Helen Rule, or Ruel, I don't know how you pronounce her name, this Jersey employment lawyer, is coming on board as well. So you've got, two, and if you include Ray O'Rourke, I don't know if he does, you say he lives in Jersey, there's a good Jersey contingent there.
Yes. Maybe he just wants some local, so he can pop round if he needs to consult them from time to time, Just could pop be. In for a cup of tea, Yeah, so I don't know whether or not the Jersey connection is significant in any way or if it's just a coincidence. I mean, obviously, Ray O'Rourke, I did a bit of research on this. When he first joined the, I think it was the Sunday Times Rich List or whatever it was, or in the top 100 rich people in the country, he was interviewed by, I think it was the Irish Independent. And he said, I'm a Dublin boy. Actually, it wasn't Dublin. I can't remember where he grew up. But anyway, came over here when he was young, worked on the London Underground and worked his way up. Now a multimillionaire. Lives in Jersey. Why not Ireland? But he lives in Jersey because he likes it there. He said, it's good lifestyle and it's close to London. It's close to Dublin. Certainly didn't move there for the tax breaks.
Very handy for London.
Yeah.
Well, let's say you've got your, if you can afford, I don't know if you've got a private helicopter or whatever, but if you've got the budget for that sort of private air travel, then everywhere's near to everywhere, isn't it?
Sure, yeah, that's true. Yeah. And I've never been to Jersey, but I'm told it's very nice.
I've been to Guernsey.
Oh, have you?
It was a bit like stepping back in time, not necessarily in a good way.
Oh, well.
Right. Okay. I think we've completed our agenda. Anything else from you, David?
No, nothing. That was it. I've come to the end of my list.
Are we? Will it be Mischief Night when we reconvene? No, not quite.
I don't know.
October next time. Right. Oh, hopefully. Just a heads up. Hopefully, when we next meet, David, I'll have been to the pictures the night before, and I'll be able to talk all about what I saw at the pictures.
Remind us what it is. You're the guest.
No. Keep it a surprise.
Oh, right. Okay. All right. Okay.
it might never happen. My train might break down or something. But all being well, I'll have been to the pictures. Yeah. Something to talk about there.
Yeah. Okay, good.
But for another episode of Reconstruction, thank you, everyone, very much indeed. And as ever and as always, I've been Phil Bishop and he's been David Taylor. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index. To keep up to date with the latest construction news and headlines, please visit theconstructionindex.co.uk and sign up for our free daily email news briefing.